Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. At least 27 people were killed, scores more wounded, in an explosion Monday near a Hindu shrine in central Bangkok, marking the worst bombing in the Thai capital in more than a decade. Thai media report four foreigners are among the dead. The explosion, which happened around 7 p.m. local time, hit near the commercial Ratchaprong intersection, which draws tourists and shoppers with its five-star hotels and upscale stores. Surveillance cameras caught the moment of the explosion as cars and motorcycles passed through the busy corner. Kiev and Moscow are accusing each other of fueling tensions as fighting in eastern Ukraine continues to escalate. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko denounced President Vladimir Putin's arrival Monday in Crimea. In a Facebook posting, Mr. Poroshenko called the Russian leader's visit to the Black Sea Peninsula a challenge to the civilized world and the continuation of the scenario to fuel tensions, which is being implemented by the Russian military and the mercenaries in eastern Ukraine. At least seven people were killed in eastern Ukraine overnight in fighting between government forces and Russian-backed separatists. Hundreds of residents in the Chinese port city of Tianjin, who were displaced after last week's massive explosions, protested Monday as the death toll from the disaster rose to 114, including 21 firefighters. The protesters were demanding the government compensate them for homes that were badly damaged from the blasts. Tianjin's vice mayor told reporters Monday that about 700 tons of the toxic chemical sodium cyanide was stored in two locations within the blast site, triggering concerns the city's water supply has been contaminated. This is VOA News. The New York Times says the Obama administration has warned China about the presence of its law enforcement agents in the U.S., covertly pressuring prominent expatriates to return home as part of Beijing's anti-corruption drive. VOA's Victor Beatty reports.
The paper, citing anonymous American officials, says Beijing has dubbed the effort Operation Fox Hunt and is part of President Xi's wider anti-corruption battle, which is popular with the Chinese public. The Times says since 2014, more than 930 suspects have been repatriated, including more than 70 who have returned voluntarily this year. It says while American officials did not disclose the identities or numbers of Chinese being sought, some are wanted for political crimes. One U.S. official says Chinese agents have been trying to track down a wealthy and politically connected businessman who fled to the U.S. last year. The paper says should he seek political asylum, he could become one of the most damaging defectors in the history of the People's Republic. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Search and rescue teams are headed to the site in a remote mountain where an Indonesian passenger plane crashed Sunday while flying through bad weather. A search plane spotted the debris from the crash of Trigana Air Flight 267 in the eastern province of Papua early Monday. The plane carried 54 passengers and crew, including five children, as well as over $470,000 in government funds to be distributed to poor families. Tensions are rising on the Korean Peninsula as North Korea resumed anti-South Korean propaganda broadcasts across their border Monday. The North is angry about the start of annual joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises. North Korea has promised to take the strongest military counteraction in response to the joint U.S.-South Korean exercises. As many as 80,000 U.S. and South Korean forces are taking part. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi signed a new anti-terrorism law Sunday that calls for the death penalty and life sentences for some offenses, while also threatening hefty fines for false reporting on terror attacks. Mr. Sisi promised in June to strengthen Egypt's anti-terror laws after a bomb killed the country's top prosecutor. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has refused to sign a peace deal aimed at ending that country's 20-month civil war. His decision is the latest blow to peace talks between the government and rebels in Addis Ababa, sponsored by the East African bloc IGAD. Asked if by VOA if this means the fighting in South Sudan will continue, rebel spokesman Stephen Parr said, apparently. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Rights groups say that Africa's most democratically and economically advanced region, Southern Africa, has recently taken a few steps back in terms of human rights. Their criticism comes as heads of state from the Southern African Development Community meet this week in Botswana.
That's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details coming up also in the news. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has refused to sign a peace deal today aimed at ending the country's 20-month civil war. We'll have these stories. Plus, the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Niger and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has refused to sign a peace deal today aimed at ending the country's 20-month civil war. His decision is the latest blow to peace talks with rebels in Addis Ababa, mediated by the East African bloc IGAD. Asked by VOA if this means fighting in South Sudan will continue, rebel spokesman Stephen Parr said, apparently. The proposed agreement was signed today by rebel leader Riek Machar and the head of South Sudan's ruling party, Pagan Amum. However, mediators are quoted as saying Amum did not represent the government. On the government's Twitter account, Mr. Kiir said, "Peace that cannot be sustained cannot be signed." The war erupted in December 2013 following a political dispute between President Kiir and Machar, his former deputy. The UN says the war has since displaced more than 2.2 million people, 1.5 million internally, and 730,000 to neighboring countries. The leader of Nigerian extremist group Boko Haram has apparently re-emerged in a new recording, declaring he is still in charge of the sect that has laid waste to a portion of Nigeria's northeast and prompted an international military response. Christine reports from Dakar.
When Abubakar Shekau wants to send a message, he usually does so on video and with bombast. But his latest message features none of the armed, masked men or piles of ammunition that are typical of his videos. Rather, Shekau's latest message is simply an audio recording. Nonetheless, he makes clear in this message that he is alive and still in charge of Boko Haram. That is at odds with recent statements made by Chadian President Idris Deby, who said last week that Shekau had been wounded and replaced by another commander as leader of the Islamist militant group. Mr. Deby also claimed the group was open to negotiating with Nigeria's government. Security analyst and associate at the Nigeria-based Network for Justice, Bawa Abdullahi Wase, says Shekau's recording is evidence of a split in the group.
He has the fear of his colleagues that they have now left him on his own, that is the commanders, the other commanders, and he has the fear of the government.
Shekau's fate has long been disputed. The Nigerian military has previously claimed to have killed him, only to see Shekau reemerge on camera. But while the group has kept releasing videos in recent months, Shekau has not appeared since February. Wase says Shekau sounds subdued in the recording, perhaps an indication that he had to flee, or was wounded in the ongoing fighting between the militaries of Nigeria and its neighbors against the insurgents.
He wouldn't want people to see him, not in physical disability. He wouldn't want people to see some sign on him that he is injured.
A task force of troops from Nigeria, Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Benin is expected to soon deploy against the extremists. The group has killed, at minimum, several hundred people since Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari took office at the end of May. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
In Nigeria, a suicide bomber killed at least three people Saturday in a village market in Borno State. Police in Ramrogo told Reuters news agency the bomber's device exploded when she was stopped by local vigilantes as she attempted to enter the busy market. No group has claimed responsibility for the explosion. Similar attacks have been blamed on Boko Haram militants. There's encouraging news today about efforts to end the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone. The World Health Organization says there were no new cases in the latest reporting period. It's the first time that's happened since the outbreak began. The WHO says the good news is due to the use of rapid response teams and strong community involvement. Sierra Leone is now down to a single chain of transmission of Ebola that started in Freetown but sparked a cluster of cases in Tonkolili in the northern part of the country. That happened when a young man who was infected traveled to the town to bring food and money to his extended family. He later died in a hospital there. Central African Republic refugees in eastern Cameroon are insisting on leaving refugee camps due to difficult living conditions. They say they are poorly fed, their children lack school and humanitarian assistance. But the government of Cameroon has been arresting refugees who leave the camps. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Garoua Boulaye in eastern Cameroon.
36-year-old Nadiko Angel has fled the refugee camp in Giwa, eastern Cameroon. She says she is in Garoua Boulaye looking for a job to raise money and assist her husband, who has been sick since they fled the Central African Republic's capital Bangui and arrived in Cameroon 1 year ago. She says her husband is suffering in the refugee camp and they do not have enough to eat. She says they are suffering a lot.
Le 22-year-old
Mokulu Lionel, who also fled from CAR's town of Braya, says he was arrested by Cameroon police and forced back to the Giwa refugee camp. He says he will never live in the camp because they do not have enough food, water, and medical care. He says he was asked to clear a farm, but after doing the job, the owner of the farm refused to pay. He says he has decided to open a garden in an unoccupied land with the hope of selling vegetables in 2 months. Cameroon estimates there are at least 200,000 CAR refugees in the Central African nation. Jean-Angebert Makala is the most senior government official in Garoua Boulaye.
Actuellement, il y a donc ce contrôle strict qui est opéré par les forces.
He says there are so many refugees escaping to towns and villages that with mounting insecurity, the government has been insisting the refugees return to the camps. He says there are strict and systematic controls organized by the police and military, especially at night, because of rising insecurity. Augustine Dolideba of the Yaoundé-based non-governmental organization Refugee Rights says the standoff between the refugees and the government of Cameroon will likely continue until peace returns to CAR and the refugees go back home.
Vous et moi, nous savons pertinemment qu'en Centrafrique, il n'y a pas la paix en ce moment. Ça, c'est bien.
He says everyone knows there is no peace in the Central African Republic and the refugees are not ready to go back. He says the governments of Cameroon and CAR should agree on how to manage the refugees because with the difficult conditions in the camps, they will never stop insisting on leaving the camps to integrate themselves with Cameroonians. Conflict began in CAR in 2013, after the Muslim Seleka rebels toppled François Bozizé's government, leading to reprisals from Christians who formed anti-Balaka militias. Last year, the government of Cameroon announced that it was not able to cope with the increasing needs of the refugees and pleaded with the international community to help. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Garoua Boulaye.
You were listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. 15 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has refused to sign a peace deal today aimed at ending the country's 20-month-old civil war. And the leader of Nigerian extremist group Boko Haram has apparently re-emerged in a new recording, declaring he is still in charge of the sect. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. Another migrant and refugee tragedy on the Mediterranean. About 50 died Saturday when they were overcome by the fumes while in the hold of a crowded fishing vessel. The dead were taken to Catania, a city on the Sicilian coast, along with more than 300 others who survived the voyage. The migrants were rescued from their sinking vessel by a Norwegian ship. Italian Foreign Minister Paolo Gentiloni told a local newspaper that Italy is conducting a major portion of the humanitarian rescues. He says some other countries are erecting walls or bickering over a few hundred migrants at their borders. He blamed the administration of former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi for ignoring Libya's tribal rivalries that led to the failure of the Libyan government after the fall of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. The International Organization for Migration says the number of migrants and refugees reaching Europe so far this year is nearly 250,000. The main routes are through Greece and across the Mediterranean Sea. Joel Millman is a spokesman for the IOM. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the rapidly rising numbers of migrants and refugees.
Greece issued new numbers last week, which came as a bit of a jump. I guess they've been undercounting for several months, which is understandable given the flood of people coming in and all the problems in that country. But we know Italy, 102,000 through the end of July. We know Greece, somewhere in the 135,000. So we're very close to a quarter million at the close of business on Friday. And, you know, rescues are occurring at over a rate of 1,000 a day. So we know we're coming very close. Before, by the end of the month, we'll definitely be at a quarter of a million. And that is a pace that's slightly ahead of last year's, just from Libya to the Italian Straits of Sicily, and with an enormous new surge coming out of Turkey, which is mainly attributed to the continuing chaos of the Syrian civil war. So we think this is going to be a bigger year than last year. It already is for deaths. We've reached 2,000 deaths much sooner than we did last year, and it is certainly ahead of the pace of total arrivals from last year.
Is Europe prepared for this influx?
Well, we believe they have the capacity, certainly. An enormous economy, a population of 500 million, they certainly can take in this number of migrants. You know, countries like Lebanon and Jordan, much smaller, are taking in many, many more people. So we know they have the capacity. Do they have the infrastructure? Have they made a plan? Not to our satisfaction. It's a very hard problem, taking people in this state. But many of them would qualify refugee asylum just no matter where they applied. One way to alleviate the strain of the day-to-day monitoring and management of this flow is to actually have refugee and asylum registries set up in the countries they're leaving from. That would solve a lot of the problems because most of them will be allowed to stay once they land anyway.
Would you be able to do that in a country like Libya?
Probably not in Libya, but certainly in Egypt, certainly in Turkey, possibly other places. We know that these things happen piecemeal. Refugees arrive in Cairo from all over, the same countries that are arriving now in Lampedusa and Greece, and they're able to be processed. It could take years. It's very slow. It's very arduous, but it is being done. So we know that the infrastructure is there. It'll be a matter of increasing the number of personnel involved and sticking to, you know, pretty clear international rules. But it could be done. You know, we think that it's important that the world realize that anything that allows legitimate refugees and migrants to access safe haven without having to go to a dangerous place like Libya is something that we think is the right solution.
Are you getting any reports from various European countries about security problems regarding the migrants and refugees?
You know, sometimes we know of crime that that occurs in association with this population. We hear about prostitution. Obviously, minimum wage crime and things like that are going on. Unlicensed vending is going on, little types of crimes like that. We've heard of one case of a man wanted for a terrorist shooting, I think, in North Africa, who did arrive on one of these boats at one time. I believe it was in Lampedusa in Italy. That's a very, very rare occasion. We haven't heard of widespread crime or mugging or breaking and entering or burglary or things like that associated with these people. Although, obviously, there are many people who are concerned that the quality of life will suffer. We don't see any evidence that's a problem.
Are you getting any reports of health problems?
Just what the migrants suffer themselves. I mean, we've had hypothermia deaths. We've had miracles of babies being born on some of these ships. But we're not hearing about any communicable diseases and things like that, no.
Now that the new operation is in effect, trying to pick up the migrants and refugees closer to the North African coast, are you seeing more lives being saved than during the previous operation?
Well, it appears as though there are more in absolute numbers, but we all notice that the recklessness of the traffickers and the smugglers and the way they're packing these boats suggest that they're not as safe as they were a year ago, and they weren't very safe then. The smugglers are overconfident that the European boats will pick them up before they get in trouble, but we've seen, you know, dozens of deaths just this past weekend. We've had days with hundreds, and so it doesn't augur well for the safety of the passage, no.
Joel Millman is a spokesman for the International Organization for Migration from Geneva. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. The African Union warns that Burundi could slide into chaos if violence continues. The chairwoman of the AU Commission, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, says further deterioration of the political crisis could have catastrophic effects for the region. Her warning yesterday follows the assassination on Saturday of a second major military figure in Burundi. Unidentified gunmen killed Colonel Jean Bikomagu, a former chief of staff. Bikomagu was army chief in 1993 when the Tutsi-dominated army fought Hutu rebels led by now President Pierre Nkurunziza. In July, Nkurunziza was declared the winner of a third term. Both political opponents and Western powers said it violated the constitution and provisions of a peace deal, which ended the 1993 to 2005 civil war between the Hutu majority and Tutsi minority. Rights groups say that Africa's most democratically and economically advanced region, Southern Africa, has taken a few steps back in terms of human rights. Their criticism comes as heads of state from the Southern African Development Community meet this week in Botswana. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
Human Rights Watch is calling on leaders meeting in Botswana to do more to stop what they say is a downward spiral of rights in the region. Most of the 15 countries in the bloc have progressive rights-respecting constitutions, says Human Rights Watch senior researcher Dewa Mavinga. The problem, he says, is that more Southern African leaders are ignoring their own laws.
There is a sense, I believe, that the authorities across Southern Africa have this sense that human rights are not universal and that there is some kind of excuse where they will be able to get away with that, not respecting human rights, and this trend is getting more entrenched.
Mavinga says it is happening not just among countries like Angola and Zimbabwe, which are frequently called out for alleged human rights abuses that go back decades, but also in South Africa, long seen as a haven for rights on the continent. For example, he cites violence against African immigrants, in which the government was accused of not doing enough to protect victims. It has also been seen more recently in the government's refusal to arrest Sudan's president, who was wanted for genocide, during a June visit for an African Union summit.
South Africa is displaying very worrying trends in terms of tolerance for the rule of law and human rights respect.
Mavinga notes Africa's constant rhetorical tug of war between development and human rights, in which leaders often defend allegations of rights abuses by countering with tales of economic and social development. He says African nations long ago committed to international conventions on human rights and are bound to obey them. Angolan activist Elias Isaac, who heads that nation's branch of the Open Society Initiative for Southern Africa, agrees. His nation is the third largest economy in sub-Saharan Africa and one of the most unequal societies in the world. He says although Angola is an extreme example, it is not an exception.
It's so difficult in Africa for you to pinpoint, you know, a good and a positive example of development that really produces social transformation, whereby this development, impacts the lives of the majority of the population. So in most countries in Africa, you know, the experience is that, you know, development only accommodates a number of people.
Human rights activists say as Southern Africa's leaders meet this week, they should agree to work for development that respects rights and benefits all. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And President Robert Mugabe has recalled Zimbabwe's parliament from its recess to amend the country's labor laws. From Harare, Sebastian Mumfu reports, unions say they are not behind the government's proposals.
The new labor law is aimed at stopping Zimbabwean employers from firing employees with little notice and no severance package. Last month, the country's Supreme Court ruled employers are allowed to fire workers with no severance as long as they give 3 months' notice. Since then, several companies, including state-owned, have terminated workers and left them empty-handed. The Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions says more than 20,000 workers have been affected. The proposed new law says an employer can only terminate a contract by mutual agreement or if the employee has been found guilty of misconduct. Otherwise, the workers would receive 2 weeks' pay for every year they served. But the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Union Secretary General Japhet Moyo says the government did not consult workers on the proposed labor law.
We seem to be sidelined. We have looked at the bill. In fact, there are more negative things in that bill than people are reading on the press. People are concentrating on a one provision, the provision to do with the termination of employment. So we are not happy with the way the envisaged act is structured as we speak now.
Specifically, Moyo said if the law is passed, the government would be allowed to control trade unions and interfere in the affairs of unions in Zimbabwe. But that might seem secondary to workers who are interested in keeping their jobs secure or at least get a severance package if their contract is terminated. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
This is African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Reuters news agency reports that South Sudan President Salva Kiir did not sign a proposed peace deal today. And Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has signed a new anti-terrorism law that calls for the death penalty and life sentences for some offenses. Coming up, music from Niger. And in our feature segment, a conversation with a migration expert and an Africa scholar about why so many Eritreans leave home. I'm Yehigis Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Sporty greetings, Yehias.
I understand you're teeing off with golf.
Yehias, you might say it's the dawning of a new day in golf. But first, sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. It's good to be back behind our VOA microphone again after some summer vacation. Special thanks to VOA's Jonah Haskell, who provided sporty relief during my absence. Here's a sunny side of sports salute to Australian golfer Jason Day, who won his first major trophy in record-breaking fashion at the PGA Championship here in the United States. The 27-year-old Day ended a year of major heartache by breaking through in victorious fashion at the Whistling Straits course in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Jason closed with a 5-under par 67 Sunday for a 3-shot victory over runner-up Jordan Spieth of the USA, who is the new world number one. Day broke Tiger Woods' major championship record for most strokes under par, finishing at 20-under, a great performance that ended with tears of joy. Day started crying before tapping in for par on the final hole. He hugged his son and wife, and then Spieth, who had beaten Day for the title at the Masters and U.S. Open earlier this year. Justin Day was in contention for the trophy at those tournaments, as well as another major, the Open Championship at St. Andrews, Scotland. The Australian says he learned a lot from those major championships, and the lessons resulted in him lifting the trophy in Wisconsin.
The biggest thing that prepares you for something like this is just the sheer experience of failure. And looking at failure not as a negative but as a positive, knowing that you can learn from anything, even if it's bad or good. And that really gets you mentally tough. Being close at the US Open, being close at the Open Championship this year, being close at Augusta, I feel like all these experiences that I've had is going to set me up for something big in the future. And for me, it would happen this week. And that's from the experience that I had in those major championships, made me mentally tough and really understand what I needed to do physically and mentally to prepare myself to win a tournament such as this.
That's Australian golfer Justin Day, the 2015 PGA champion. Day set a record by finishing at 20 under par, 268, the most strokes under par at a major championship.
Voice of America! I had the voice of America calling on my wavelength. Bound was coming out of Frankfurt, I made. I had the voice of America trolling on my wavelength. Singing, come back, baby, come back. Come back, baby, come back.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America. Joining us now with a package of African football news is our friend in Lagos, Segun Dot on the spot, Adeyemi.
Good evening, Africa.
The local organizing committee for the 2015 CAF Under 23 Championship was inaugurated in Dakar, capital of the host nation of Senegal. The tournament will run from November 28th to December 12th in two cities, the capital city of Dakar and Mbor, which is located 80 kilometers from the capital. The final of the Under 23 Championship will feature 8 teams. Joining host Senegal are Algeria, Egypt, Mali, Nigeria, South Africa, Tunisia, and Zambia. The top three teams at the tournament will qualify to represent Africa at the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The fourth place team will engage in a playoff with an Asian side. The final draw for the tournament will be held on September 14th at the CAF headquarters in Cairo, Egypt. And from Rwanda comes the report that celebrated Ghana under 20 coach Selassie Tete has been loaned out by the Ghana Football Association to take charge of the Lyon Stars, Sierra Leone's senior national side, for 3 months. The Sierra Leone Football Association, SLFA, is currently searching for a substantive coach. The association has so far shortlisted 5 coaches from Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Serbia. Pending the appointment of a coach, the SLFA sent a request to its Ghanaian counterpart for assistance with one of its experienced coaches, hence the decision to send Tete. The 58-year-old Tete won the FIFA Under-20 World Cup for Ghana in 2009 and previously coached the Rwandan national team. Tete's first assignment will be in about 3 weeks when Sierra Leone hosts African champion Ivory Coast in the 2017 Nations Cup qualifiers. Staying with African football, African soccer's governing body, CAF, will carry out a second inspection of facilities in Rwanda from August 23rd to 28th, ahead of the 2016 African Nations Championship, scheduled for January 16th to February 7th. The 7-member CAF inspection team will be led by CAF Vice President Amami Kabili Kamara. The delegation will look at stadiums, training facilities, and hotels in the 3 host cities of Kigali, Huye, and Rubavu. The draw for the championship's final phase will be held on November 18th in Kigali. The African Nations Championship is designed exclusively for players who feature in their domestic leagues. Ghana is planning a friendly with Congo next month before engaging Rwanda in the 2017 African Nations Cup qualifier. The match will be played on September 1st, 4 days before the Black Stars play the Amavubi Stars in Kigali in the Group H qualifier. Ghana's opponent in the 2017 Nations Cup qualifiers, Rwanda, has also lined up a friendly against Ethiopia at the Amahoro Stadium. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station, of course, with partner, the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, has more sports news for us. And Mark begins with a big honor for a Malawian netball player.
Malawian Mwai Kumwenda was crowned the 2015 Netball World Cup Player of the Tournament in Sydney, Australia on Sunday. Kumwenda stole the limelight after emerging the tournament's top scorer with 321 goals. She is credited with a 91% scoring rate in 8 matches Malawi played at the global contest. Staying in Sydney, South Africa pipped Malawi 48-46 in the 5th place playoff at the Netball World Cup on Sunday. Wales outplayed Uganda 64-41 in the seventh place playoff, while Barbados prevailed over Zambia 53-38 in the 13th place playoff. Earlier on, tournament debutants Zambia salvaged a measure of national pride with their first two triumphs on the world stage when they dismissed Sri Lanka 70-36 and Singapore 67-36 in classification ties on Saturday and Friday, respectively. Australia won the World Cup, New Zealand placed second, England a bronze medalist, and Jamaica fourth. Turning to handball, Egypt put up a brave fight before going down 31-26 to Sweden as Tunisia lost 28-14 to Denmark in the round of 16 at the Men's Youth World Handball Championships in Yekaterinburg, Russia, on Sunday. Earlier on Friday, Tunisia edged Japan 29-26 as Egypt pipped Germany 24-23 to ensure an African presence in the knockout stage of the tournament, while Croatia dismissed Algeria 32-22. Moving on to volleyball, Algeria outclassed hosts Morocco in straight sets of 26-24, 25-22 and 26-24 to clinch their first Arab Boys Youth Volleyball Championship title in Sahel on Friday. It's also Morocco's first appearance in the finals of the biannual contest. Qatar outplayed Tunisia 28-26, 25-20 and 25-16 to retain the bronze medal they first won in Tunisia 2 years ago. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited. Because
this is Africa. This time for Africa.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. Follow The Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a photo of me with Nigerian striker Francisca Ordega, who scored a goal for the Super Falcons at this year's Women's World Cup football tournament in Canada. Ordega is based right here in Washington with the Washington Spirit Club in the National Women's Soccer League. And for our VOA listeners who can tune in our Africa 54 television program, I profiled the 21-year-old Ordega during Monday's show. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's The Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yeheus Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to The Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, San has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. The number of migrants and refugees sailing the Mediterranean has continued to rise in the first 7 months of 2015. Most of them are Syrians who are escaping war, but the small African nation of Eritrea ranks number two with higher numbers than Ethiopia, Somalia, or Sudan. Some Eritreans pay smugglers as much as $3,000 and risk their lives passing through dangerous regions to reach the European promised land. In the first of five reports on the Eritrean refugees, VOA's David Arnold talked to migration expert and an Africa scholar about why so many Eritreans leave their homeland.
Since Eritrea achieved independence in 1991, President Isaias Afwerki's unchallenged 24-year rule has not produced the achievements envisioned when rebels in sandals won a 30-year guerrilla war and re-entered the capital, Asmara. That's also the view of a few outsiders who've managed to follow independent Eritrea's recent history. Bronwyn Brutland is the deputy director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center in Washington, D.C., and she is an observer of Eritrea's post-independence struggles.
There are a very large number of Eritreans fleeing across the Mediterranean, particularly relative to Eritrea's size. Eritrea has a population of about 6.5 million people. And last year, it's believed that there were at least 45,000 refugees that fled. And that was a significant increase over previous years. The amount of refugees appears to have tripled in the last year or so, well, since the beginning of 2014.
The European Union is conflicted over the massive migrant flows from Syria and some African countries. The 28 member states of the EU debate whether Eritreans in particular are coming because they are poor or because they are repressed. Leonard Doyle of the International Office for Migration says it really doesn't matter because migration is a natural global phenomenon of people trying to better themselves. But he says Eritrea surely qualifies on economic grounds.
Well, the economy is poor. It's been relatively easy to get into Europe, as that is the case. You know, it would be in the self-interest of any family for their young people to go off to Europe and make the fortune. Unfortunately, it's not really the best way to do things, because they can be robbed, they can be beaten up, they can, you know, lose their life along the way. And if they get to Europe, they're unlikely. Well, even if they get political asylum, without skills, they're not necessarily going to be in a position to contribute.
One indicator of the unusual nature of Eritrea's migration is the high number of children who escape from the country. Many believe Eritrea's children are escaping their government's national service, a kind of forced labor.
Well, about 34,000 arrived by sea to Italy alone last year, including nearly 5,000 unaccompanied minors.
Some say Eritrea's estimated 45,000 active duty military and 250,000 reservists are said to constitute one of the largest armies in Africa, with probably the highest ratio of conscripted citizens. The force is based on mandatory national service for all able-bodied men and women. It was inspired by a long and costly war with neighboring Ethiopia over a border debate that is still unsettled. Critics say Eritrea soldiers have to serve for as many as 10 years, maintaining national security, building roads, and some say working for foreign mining companies. Bruton says national service is a major factor in the migration patterns.
The reasons that people are fleeing, I think, are a little unclear. On the one hand, historically, Eritrea has had a national conscription program, which is a period of national service that in theory was supposed to last for 18 months, but in practice has often been indefinite. The conditions of the service have been very unpleasant. People are paid very small amounts of money. There have been allegations of brutality, torture, sexual abuse. There have been allegations that people who are critical of members of the government, for example, can be arrested and detained indefinitely without due process of law.
Eritrea appears near the bottom of most country-by-country rankings on various indices. Number 181 for human development, 155th for democracy, 189th for ease of doing business, 174th for economic freedom. For the last 8 years, a survey by World Press Freedom ranks Eritrea last. In early June, the UN Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in Eritrea reported possible crimes against humanity in the arbitrary arrest of journalists. Doyle just looks at the numbers and counts Eritreans leaving.
I think it's changing, but heretofore, if anyone fled Eritrea without doing their military service, they were kind of on the wrong side of the law. So there was a tendency to automatically give people from Eritrea refugee status. But that seems to be changing due to changes within Eritrea itself. It's not so clear anymore. But nonetheless, one of the country's big exports is its people, so they keep heading to Europe.
During Bruton's visit to Eritrea, she was told by many government officials and by Mr. Isaias himself that Eritrea is opening its doors and it is demobilizing some of its national service forces. This is David Arnold at VOA in Washington.
In Ghana, a new initiative could provide employment opportunities for 1,000 Ghanaian youth in tech-related services. The effort is called the Digital Youth Empowerment Project.
It's being managed by the Media Foundation for West Africa in partnership with the telecommunications service provider MTN Ghana. The target includes people between the ages of 18 and 30 years. The project's executive director, Suleiman Brayama, says it's part of a broader scheme to provide greater internet freedom in West Africa. Mr. Brayama explains the new model to reporter Joanna Manti in Accra.
First of all, we are looking at how can we empower young people who have ambitions, who have ideas, who have innovations, to be able to jumpstart certain projects they may have, to be able to develop applications that may be on and for one reason or the other has been stalled. How can we connect people who have already developed very great innovative applications and connecting them with industry, connecting them with potential users, connecting them with service providers, and so on and so forth.
So what type of people are we looking at? Are you looking at people with university degrees?
I would say that we are looking at people, first of all, who have interest in ICTs, whether they are high school graduates, whether they have diplomas, whether they even have basic school qualification. Because sometimes with ICT, it doesn't really call for the ability to read and write. It's actually a passion. And someone who is interested in, okay, I want to learn how to code. I want to learn how I can put people together to develop a blog. And out of that, at some point, we monetize the blog and that becomes an avenue for job creation for young people.
Is this something that will lead them to develop their own jobs using the internet, or just gaining skills to work for the private or public sector?
I think it's both. Those who are interested ultimately in developing their IT skills and they are not interested in starting something on their own, but having the necessary and relevant skills to be gainfully employed, either by organizations in the IT industry, public sector, private sector, or even creating a blog with colleagues and eventually monetizing that blog to be able to have some capital that would eventually lead them to developing something on their own.
How long will the training last? And are they going to be funded after finishing this project?
This project is going to be a continuous project. For now, the initial phase is a two-year intervention. In terms of the training, we have, for example, regional digital youth expos, which are the mentoring and coaching sessions for young people. We are building what we call the Digital Youth Infobank, which is an online platform that is going to connect young people who are interested in innovations, ICT, digital stuff, to connect and share ideas, to learn about what others are doing, to tap into ideas that other people may have, and so on. Apart from that, we are looking at having what we call Digital Apps Fair, which will be an avenue for young people who have developed applications to come and showcase their applications, connect with industry, and so on. And then eventually we also have the Digital Entrepreneurship Startup Support, which will be a kind of startup support to support people to kickstart whatever ideas they may have in terms of becoming entrepreneurs.
Can you name examples of these jobs that they are likely to go into?
For example, we have folks who have created what is known as iLabs across Africa. But if young people, for example, decide that we are app developers, that what we do is to look at the problems of our society and create apps that can help solve these problems, and we need a startup support that will help us, you know, day to day develop the apps, and then through the project also connect with industry players who may use it, public sector institutions, for whom these applications will be relevant. And of course, then it means that these institutions will have to invest in these people. Either they are buying the apps or they are investing in its scale up and so on. Even people say, okay, we are interested in developing a platform that connects farmers and helps them to know what kind of fertilizer to use, what kind of markets to be looking out for. And for example, the Ministry of Agriculture finds this useful. We would be willing to support such young people to develop such ideas, to come up with that, and then partner with the industry. Even development of softwares, development of web portals that are for a particular purpose. So anything that is innovative and is in the realm of ICT and the digital world.
That was Suleimana Brayama of the Digital Youth Empowerment Project. He was speaking with reporter Joanna Manti in Accra, Ghana. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehisu Hib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing and the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
While the outbreak of Ebola virus disease that killed more than 11,280 people in West Africa has trailed off considerably, it is not yet over. Only 5 new cases were reported in the 2 weeks ending August 9th, 2 in Sierra Leone and 3 in Guinea. This is the lowest number of new cases reported since March 2014, and down from a long period during 2015 when there were 20 to 30 new cases each week. Without a doubt, the reason we have seen such results is because we stood as a united front in combating the disease, said USAID Acting Administrator Alfonso Lenhart at a July 10th UN International Ebola Recovery Conference. The epidemic may be waning, but its effects ripple far beyond the disease itself. Young people stopped going to school, and trade declined as countries closed their borders, said Acting Administrator Lenhart. The outbreak stretched the limits of entire institutions, from health ministries to infrastructure. That must now be rebuilt. Getting to zero, no new cases, will require continued follow-up from governments, donors, international aid groups, and NGOs. The systems that have been built to detect, track, and treat Ebola must not be dismantled prematurely. As the scope of the Ebola epidemic grew during 2014, the United States stepped up to help, so far providing nearly $2 billion for response efforts, including funding and training for thousands of healthcare workers, construction of 15 Ebola treatment units in Liberia, delivery of equipment and medicines, and provisions of laboratories. Now, to help with the recovery, the U.S. government will provide an additional $266 million. These funds will help Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea fix critical gaps in their health care and emergency response systems, as well as schools, water and food supply, and other sectors damaged by the Ebola crisis. As we continue on the road to zero cases, the United States is here to support the people of West Africa as they begin the long process of rebuilding and restoring their livelihoods and personal development, said Acting Administrator Lenhart. The United States remains committed to supporting our partners in each country as they transition from crisis to recovery.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, what's your sign? Do you believe in horoscopes? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests debating this issue. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.